This is heavy stuff. Now, as I was saying, there's nothing mysterious about antimatter. A particle and an antiparticle are identical in almost every respect, except that they carry opposite electric charges. That's what marriage has been about for years. These people run around trying to cross the circuits, and they're messing things up. Now, some of you think that I don't know what I'm going to talk about tonight. I know exactly what I'm going to talk about. I'm tired of reading all this funny stuff. This strange stuff, and this far-out stuff. I said I'd bring a scientific book tonight. Black holes and warp space-time. Bob Hope would pay you guys. I haven't said my funniest parts yet. I'm tired of reading this weird stuff. Somebody's going to think I've flipped. So I decided I'd be scientific tonight. There's nothing mysterious about antimatter. You know what antimatter is? It ain't matter. Now, I didn't say it don't matter. I said it ain't matter. Not only that, it can't matter either. And matter can't antimatter. Antimatter's antimatter, and matter's matter. But there's nothing mysterious about it. Nothing mysterious about antimatter. A particle and an antiparticle. Now, I'm telling you, some antiparticles will get you. Like the preacher got in a fight with that bully, and the bully said, "You better run." He says, "Well, you better worry about the three fellows that are with me." You know that story, don't you? God and Christ and the Holy Ghost. And the bully says, "I don't see him." And the preacher says, "Them's the one who'll get you." Now, things wrong with this world. Too many of you been living not being aware of antimatter. You think all that matters is matter. But there's antimatter. And there's nothing mysterious about antimatter. It says it right there. This science book. There is nothing mysterious about antimatter. Can't you find that? There's nothing mysterious about antimatter. It's what it said. It's what he said. That means we're saying the same thing. You better go out and get yourself a fur coat tonight, or you might turn into antimatter. I decided we'd keep it cool enough for Sammy tonight. I prepared. There is nothing mysterious about antimatter. I've been watching it get warm in here and you going to sleep every night. I'm going to make it so cold tonight that if you go to sleep, your snot will freeze, and when you snore, you'll pierce your brain with an icicle. Craig says, "That's cold." There is nothing mysterious about antimatter. A particle and an antiparticle are identical in almost every respect, except that they carry opposite electric charges. For example, an anti-electron has a positive charge, whereas an ordinary electron carries a negative charge. That's what I said. By always creating particles and antiparticles in equal numbers, nature ensures that electric charge is not magically produced out of nothingness. What do you expect? This is a university network. I always have some of these traditional saints call me every night and say, "Can you save me?" No. They're like the fellow that gotten Lorne Fox's healing line up in Oroville. He was there every night for 6 nights. My dad says, "Haven't I seen you here before?" He says, "Yeah." "Well, are you getting healed?" "No," he says, "but the treatments are feeling good." Lorne would touch him and he'd fall, and old Cecil would catch him and set him down gently. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
As long as particles and antiparticles spontaneously appear or disappear in pairs, who would want to disappear any other way? Nature's electric charge balance sheet is always satisfied. The problem we got over there on the national lines is two antimatters are sitting side to side. Two of them. If we get a positive particle between them, we might get something worthwhile. The time intervals over which this process occurs are incredibly brief. For example, during an interval of 1 billion trillionth of a second, that is what I said. Very simple, folks. If you had any mathematical knowledge and any mathematical ability, you could put it up there instantly and know exactly what it is. 10^23. That's how fast it occurs. Yet it's incredibly simple. Nothing mysterious about antimatter, it's just fast. That's what I said. The time intervals over which this process occurs are incredibly brief. For example, during an interval of 1 billion trillionth. Just multiply that out. 10 × 10 × 10 × 10 × 10^23 times, that's what you get. Do it right now. This is a university network. During an interval of 1 billion trillionth of a second, an electron and an anti-electron can spontaneously appear and disappear. And this can occur absolutely anywhere. It can also occur with more massive particles. Craig and Sam. But because of the reciprocal nature of the uncertainty principle, these more massive particles can exist only for correspondingly shorter time intervals. You guys are getting your psychoanalysis free tonight. For example, the proton, well, wait a minute. For example, the proton is 2,000 times as heavy as the electron. Now take one good look, folks, and figure it out for yourself. Therefore, put up "Take Me to the Water." Therefore, pairs of protons and antiprotons can appear and disappear provided they last for only 1/2000th as long as the pairs of electrons and anti-electrons. That's why I have more of the rest of us here. Got it figured out? Now, one of the functional doctrines of subatomic physics, usually attributed to Murray Gell-Mann of Caltech, is if it's not strictly forbidden, then it must occur. I'm telling you, you can say these scientists are dry if you want to, but I'm exposing the real truth. I believe I'll read that again. From Caltech, no less. If it's not strictly forbidden, then it must occur. It refers to any quantum process. That's what they are. Therefore, you following this now? Therefore, pairs of every conceivable particle and antiparticle are constantly being created and destroyed everywhere. The Lord's working slow on the second half of that part, the destroying part. The question is, will they destroy us before themselves be thusly committed? Therefore, pairs of every conceivable particle and antiparticle are constantly being created and destroyed everywhere at every location all across the universe. Now, I want my time buyer to send this particular tape to all stations who want a sample tape of what the University Network does. Therefore, pairs of every conceivable particle and antiparticle are constantly being created and destroyed everywhere, at every location, all across the universe. Of course, we have no way of directly observing these pairs of particles and antiparticles, except the shaman. That is forbidden by the uncertainty principle. The particle-antiparticle pairs simply exist for such short time intervals that direct observation is impossible, and for this reason they're called virtual pairs. They don't really exist. They virtually exist. Not virtuously. Virtually. There's a difference. I'm very sure that Craig and Sam virtually exist. I will not vouch for the other part. In fact, I don't even want to know about the other part. Considering they're massive particles, I doubt I'd find it interesting. Would you? Though virtual pairs of particles and antiparticles cannot be directly observed, present company being the exception, their effects have been detected. I'd like to tell all you folks on the national line that Craig sent his clothes out for laundry yesterday, if you haven't figured it out already for yourself. Their effects have been detected. Imagine. Am I boring you? Now, I want you to know that a true-false test in this will not... Although virtual pairs of particles and antiparticles cannot be directly observed, their effects have been detected. Imagine an electron in orbit around or about the nucleus of an atom, such as a hydrogen atom. Ideally, the electron should follow its orbit in a smooth, unhampered fashion. That's me. But because of constant brief appearance and disappearance of pairs of particles and antiparticles, that's them. Tiny electric fields exist for extremely short intervals of time. Sparks. When I ever ever get worked up or mad, they're the reasons. Them antiparticles and particles over there. These tiny, fleeting electric fields cause the electron to jiggle slightly in its orbit. That's me. This jiggling was first detected in 1947. I was born in 1929. I've been all shook up. This jiggling was first detected in 1947 by W.E. Lamb and R.C. Rutherford, who noticed a tiny shift in the spectrum of light from the hydrogen atom. This phenomenon is known as the Lamb shift. You got it? The Lamp shift. It provides powerful support for the ideas that it's too hot in here. Sparks are flying. It provides powerful support for the idea that every point in space all across the universe is seething with virtual pairs of particles and antiparticles. Am I boring you? This gets heavy. The concept of virtual pairs also provides a ready explanation for the phenomenon of pair production. For many years, it has been known that highly energetic gamma rays can convert their energy into pairs of particles and antiparticles according to the equation E equals MC2 square. That's what I said. You don't even have to get out of grammar school to figure out that 2 means squared. Been a while, but I've been to grammar school. Quite simply, the gamma ray disappears upon colliding with a second photon, and in its place a particle and antiparticle appear. This process is commonly observed in high-energy nuclear experiments. Indeed, it's one way in which nuclear physics can manufacture many exotic species of particles and antiparticles. Where do these particles and antiparticles come from? Lord, I wish I knew. Every time Craig arrives, he's from a different place. Where do these particles and antiparticles come from? They spring from nature's ample supply of virtual pairs. You mean there's more like them? The gamma ray provides a virtual pair with so much energy that the virtual particles can materialize and appear as real particles in the real world. Now, let me go further. You may have thought I was trying to do a comedy routine. Here's scientific definition of materialization in the unseen world, but it's a matter of relativity. We just don't know how to do it yet. We know how to dematerialize to the degree we can change the makeup of reality and get a great explosion and split the atoms and endanger ourselves to the point that it's possible to blow the world up. It won't happen because God will see to it. But where does the supernatural and the natural begin and end? Maybe that's relative, and the real difference is source and quality. And visible and invisible, rather than mystical and normal. And I'm going to tell you, that's truer to the biblical frame than the super-spiritual religious people are. What turned me off on religion was the tendency to make spirituality weird. Heaven's out there. But out there includes black holes. What's a black hole? Here's attempts to diagram one. Now, the gravitational effect of light makes what you see not true. See, the shaman state of consciousness sees what we see as not true and what he sees as true. And by the way, I still need help from my audience because we have tried all day. We've called the National Geographic. We've called the stations that were given to us last night, and we're still unable to locate that movie that many of you have seen on television of the shaman who converted his subjects into, I remember one, a boar, a wild boar who ate poisonous roots somewhere in Southeast Asia. I really need help from people that saw it, have contacts. I want to find that film, its source. We called the National Geographic Society, and the clerk we reached said it wasn't in their files. So if any of you know, please help us again tonight. But a black hole is so strong in its gravitation that if you are looking through space to a star, get the picture here. If you're looking through space to a star, the light rays are so bent by the gravitational pull that the real path of the light goes down. See it curve down? Let me get a pencil and then I can make it flow for you. Now, let's talk about a black hole for a minute. White dwarfs, if you take the Earth and compress it down to a marble, it might become a white dwarf, though it might take more than that. You'd so compress the mass that though small in size, the gravitational pull would increase with the compression of that mass until, if you were to step on it, you'd become a pancake. Keep carrying it further, there is a point of inversion where analogous to, but not the same as, you pass from matter to antimatter. You pierce that barrier, and it becomes nothing from the side of the universe as we know it. We don't know what's on the other side. And matter has either dematerialized to nothing, and yet it had within itself the pull of gravity from the compression as a white dwarf. Just keep compressing it. And yet, you can't see it because light doesn't escape from a black hole. But you can find its position in space because a star's light passing by a black hole bends down. See, it isn't in the hole, but even nearby it passes and bends down in the gravitational suction, climbs out on the other side, and hits our eye. We're looking, and we think the star is there. Straight line, shortest distance between two points. We see the star is there. It really is here. Now, what's appearance and what's reality? Now, this is a gravitational curvature of space trying to give a little impression of the beginning of what becomes a black hole. Let me give you another picture. The embedding gravitational pull increases as the gravity heats up. Eventually, maybe I can find a picture here somewhere, the black hole becomes a bridge. And some theorists have said in one section of space it goes in, comes out on another section of space. Others view it theoretically like this. The truth is they don't know where it goes. And some spiritualist theorists have said a black hole becomes the entrance to heaven. You move into a realm, again, not antimatter, but analogous to the opposite. Take the theory of antimatter, particles and antiparticles, matter and antimatter. And for all the universes we know it, the opposite, unseen, is there to balance on a grand scale. Now, we're discussing the extraterrestrial, the preternatural, to borrow another phrase, the supernatural, which can't be translated literally, the more natural, the unseen, the invisible. Didn't Paul say we look not on the things which are seen, but on the things which are unseen? Things which are seen are temporal, things which are unseen are eternal. Wasn't the church built in a spiritual experience where a reality not seen literally infilled the believers and gave them an infusion of life and power that brought the church into existence and began to fulfill the harvest festival's meaning, which was a shadow of things to come? Passage after passage that I've been referring to the last few days, the servant of the prophet in the Old Testament that has his eyes open and sees the hosts of the Lord in camp, Jesus' statement, legions of angels he could call on when he told Peter to put his sword away. And where did Jesus go when he said, "Touch me not, I haven't yet ascended to the Father"? And where did he go when he ascended? And in the high priestly prayer, he said, among other things, he was going to come back and get us and take us to that place. And what is the rapture of the church, which literally means catching away? Now, my purpose in teaching is to prove that the grand old book is not as stupid as some men have made it. And that the God who created all of this did not get his foot in his mouth, but a pea-brained world that thought they had compressed reality and put it in their little materialistic box are now being forced to encounter reality extra to themselves, larger than themselves, outside themselves, and inside themselves. And I happen to be dealing with the darker side, the evil side, demonology. Now, many people have asked me, have you got a copy of the book, The Beautiful Side of Evil? Yes. It raises the question, are all healings from God? And I can tell you going out the gate, no. And the title is immediately intriguing, The Beautiful Side of Evil. Now, last night I was on shamanism. For some of you, you'll have to wait the rerun to get it. I brought another book tonight on the shaman, The Wounded Healer by Joan Halifax. Shaman. Now, Joan Halifax is no kook. Joan Halifax, PhD, medical anthropologist and director of the Ojai Foundation, has worked with healers and shamans the world over. Some of you will remember that I said, if miracles are going to turn you on, you're a setup for Antichrist. And I attended a Shinto sect meeting in Japan and watched with my two eyes as the Shinto sect leader laid hands on a fever-racked, sick person on a cot. And that person instantly got up well. Don't need somebody to tell me about that. And I used to discuss this with Dr. Kishimoto when I was in individual study with him at Stanford University, who was guest professor for 5 years in this country from University of Tokyo. Though Buddhism and mountain worship in Japan, two different kinds of religion, were his specialties, he also was expert in the Shinto sects in Japan. Miracles are not unique to Christianity and to God and to God's servants. And if you want to take the text out of context, nobody can perform these miracles except to be from God. You're going to get yourself in a black hole, my friend, that ain't the other side of heaven. Now, I'm sure I've been scaring a few people. Hope I've been waking some people up. I got 9 years of solid teaching, and I'd like my teaching to be set in that solid context as I deal with this subject. I'm still the same teacher, teaching the same truth, that God's Word will stand the test of the modern scientific community. If you don't want to follow God as a matter of choice, that's your business. But I'm sick and tired of a generation being turned off from God because they think you have to park your head and brains at the door to become a Christian. You don't have to cease to be a Christian because it will not stand up on even peer level with any philosophy in the modern world. Joan Halifax, alongside research at Columbia and Miami universities, the Musée de L'Homme in Paris and the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center, where she was concerned with those dying of cancer. She has assisted Joseph Campbell on his historical atlas of world mythology. A Harvard faculty member, she's co-author of The Human Encounter with Death and author of Shamanic Voices. What I'm dealing with is not just the property of the nutty fringe. That's the point I'm making. A little book in my pocket tonight. My Search for the Ghost of Flight 401 by Elizabeth Fuller. Could have been a good book. Can you please explain the difference between agnostic and atheist, please? Well, an atheist does not believe. The literal meaning of atheist is the opposite of theist. As pistis is faith and apistis is disfaith, atheist is the opposite. Generically and reportedly, it's come to mean anyone that doesn't believe in God. Though more strictly speaking, a personal God. I suppose you could believe in God by some definition and strictly speaking be atheist, but generally and reportedly it means you don't believe in God and you're settled in that position. You believe there is no God. Agnostics are not sure. They're still searching. I'm an agnostic faither. Faith is like gaining enough momentum in your research about some things that in your field of reality you can put a solid peg in the middle of a circle, and you're willing to hang your life on that and let experience verify it or shake it. And those solid pegs are surrounded by a lot that aren't quite as solid and gets grayer as you go out. So a true searcher after truth remains agnostic on many areas, and his agnosticism settles one way or the other after research and experience until you become a believer or a fixed disbeliever. Agnosticism is not sure and still searching. Strictly speaking, it's the opposite of Gnostic. A Gnostic knows, an agnostic doesn't know. That answer you? My Search for the Ghost of Flight 401. I said 411, 401. Any of you ever heard of the ghost of Flight 401? A plane that crashed down in Florida, in the Everglades, and a certain flight engineer, Don Repo, I think's his name. I'll check it in here later. Yeah, repo. Hung around. Some flight engineer on another L-1011 was down in the galley, which you know on the L-1011s is down an elevator and lower. And suddenly, a flight engineer, namely Don Repo, who had been killed in the crash, materialized and says, "Don't worry about the pre-flight check, I've already done it." Now, I never did find out whether that engineer that went down there to check needed an elevator to get back up to the main floor or not. I'm going to have mercy on you. Help me out, somebody. Get that thing over there. Help me. Help me. Help me now. Now listen. Too cold in here. Turn the heat up. Don't ever say I didn't do anything for you. I never did find out whether that flight attendant used the elevator to get back up to the main deck or not. Wouldn't surprise me any if they caught him somewhere over the Rockies. Then this same flight engineer or attendant or whatever he was, Don Repo, materialized on a plane or on a pre-flight checkup or something, told him, "Watch out, there'd be a fire in engine 3 or something like that. And there was. And they had to land with less than a complete flotilla of engines. Now, I had an Eastern stewardess, I think it was, the other night, call and say, "Please talk on this subject. We're not allowed to. We'll get fired if we do." It's been rumored with consistency throughout the airline industry for several years since the crash. And after a couple of people who believe in these things, two separate ones, by the way, a couple in one case, another one, did a soul freeing. Now, to those who use this language, exorcism casts out evil spirits. Soul freeing sets a departed spirit or soul of one, I'm using their terms, who has died free from its either confusion or hangover attachment to this life. I can tell you, too, that you'll have to set their souls free when they go, and that's Sammy and Craig. Set it free to go and accept the fact that it's heading for a new world. If I hadn't been teaching all these weeks so seriously, I'd already be canceled out tonight on this subject. But there's a gestalt I've wanted to come through. I read from Beowulf, the historic myth of the Scandinavian peoples. The classic fight between the denizens of the underworld, Grendel and his crowd, in that state, because in that myth they'd kill Cain. Well, the Bible has a terrible punishment for those that kill Cain. I read from the Judaic Encyclopedia the demonology and the realization that the King James doesn't help us too much in the study of demonology. They call things devils that are specific, proper names of heathen gods. And they call things screech owls and wild beasts, disconsolate ones, which are proper names of demons in a hierarchy of demons. There's little doubt about what Jesus encountered demons from the demoniac of the Gadarenes to one that was in a synagogue. There can be no question as the Antichrist symbol, if it is a symbol, I believe it's a real person. But if you're a neo-Orthodox theologian, you'll treat it as a myth of the end time, which simply says that sin, whatever its form, will get worse, and the last expression of sin in history is the worst expression of sin. And the neo-Orthodox people who finally came to understand that sin was real did recognize the answer came from beyond history. And the last expression of sin, the worst kind. I'm literal in that sense. I believe Antichrist is a real person, real ruler, possessed of a demon. But there can be no doubt that there's not only an intensification of sin toward the end, there's an intensification of demon work. Demons released out of the bottomless pit in the book of Revelations are now helicopter. And pilots and guns shooting off of them. They're demons, scorpion demons, led by a ruler demon called Abaddon. 200 million demons have been chained unseen, caged, if you will, in the area around the Euphrates River to be released during the tribulation. Now, the Bible's been laughed at for postulating this other realm, extraterrestrial UFOs, my Lord, extraterrestrial visits to this planet. That's going on in the Bible. Elijah takes off. No wonder Elisha says, my father, the chariot of the Lord and the horsemen thereof. You say, well, that's a vision. Tell Elijah, he's gone. I mean, it was one powerful dematerialization. You say, well, he just was nothing. Well, he showed up again on the Mount of Transfiguration. Right there with Moses. And the book of Jude says, Lucifer and Michael, the archangel, fought over the body of Moses. And Lucifer lost. You suppose the fight was very important because Moses had in his afterlife destiny to show up on that Mount of Transfiguration to encourage Christ? Or let's take a very prestigious evangelical Bible teacher, J. Sidlow Baxter, who does not conclude but offers solid evidence that Moses and Elijah just might be the last two witnesses in the book of Revelation, where two witnesses come, work miracles, nobody can touch them, then they're slain, the world looks at them laying in the streets, and then they're raptured, translated, called away. Extraterrestrial visitors, two witnesses, and then they go back. Now, the argument has been, it's pointed unto man wants to die. Therefore, everybody has to die. Therefore, Enoch didn't die. Therefore, Enoch has to be one of those witnesses because he didn't die. Well, go ahead. Make Enoch your choice. Doesn't matter to me. It's two. Jay said, but Baxter's argument is they are witnesses. And what do they bear witness to the world in the last day? Well, Moses and Elijah were witness of his transfiguration. Their name there. We don't know who the witnesses of the resurrection were, the two shining ones. We don't know who the witnesses of the ascension were who said, why stand you gazing up into heaven? Chances are, same one. Now, rather than Satan fighting for the body of Moses because he had some advanced knowledge that Moses would be there to encourage Jesus at a critical time, maybe Satan knew. You know, house cleaning is never a big problem to me. I I mean, you know, I'm sitting here trying to spin around on my chair and I'm slipping and sliding with this paper. I got to get some grip.
This is the end of side one. For the rest of the teaching, please turn the tape over for side two. Thank you.